This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Stingray pods are populating our beaches for the summer, meaning the chances of accidentally stepping on one increases. In self-defense, they flip up their tail, and that venomous barb at the end of the tail could land you in the emergency room. Later in the show, we'll talk about ways to avoid that with a leading stingray researcher. Plus, we'll learn how these ancient creatures are contributing to cutting-edge scientific research. But first, women's self-defense classes have been going on since the emergence of the first women's rights movements of the early 1900s. And yet hundreds of thousands of women fall victim to sexual predators every year. And that's not even taking into account the number of children and men who are victimized. According to the latest statistics, just over a quarter of all rapes are committed by a stranger. Most are by known acquaintances. So why are we teaching women to avoid being victims instead of teaching potential predators to stop victimizing? Can a predator be taught to stop? And what can a family or friend do if they fear someone might be a potential attacker? Joining us to talk more about these themes is Scott Johnson, who's a forensic psychologist who consults with law enforcement across the country and is also a professor here at FGCU. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are talking about sexual predators and ways to stop these kinds of attacks and abuses before they start. How do you talk to your kids about staying safe from predators? And have you ever confronted a potential victimizer head on? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So, Scott Johnson, as a forensic consultant and psychologist, your specialty is in sexual predators and physically violent offenders. What is the connection there?
Well, it's basically about a violent personality, people that have beliefs that it's okay to hurt people, to put their needs over others, a lack of conscience, lack of empathy, and how they primarily demonstrate it. They may be primarily physical abusers most of the time, but also sexually offend, and certainly sex offenders also use physical violence.
It's easy. It's kind of a blurry line there between the two.
Very blurry.
So if someone is a sexual predator, will they always be one? Is it like addiction or mental illness? Can someone be rid of that compulsion, or is it something they're always going to fight?
The majority are going to still always have that compulsion to hurt people. Now, how they choose to deal with the compulsion is really what matters. But over 50%, probably 60% or better over a 20-25 year period are going to reoffend.
Is that a result of them not having follow-up after they've offended? Is there enough in place that can help, like, reprogram, I guess, or to the kinds of counseling or coping mechanisms being offered to these people once they're put back into society?
Well, we certainly could have more aftercare follow-up services for physically and sexually violent offenders. However, part of this is, you know, personality is established at a young age. And changing our belief system is actually a very difficult thing. You have to want to do it. And so even if we offer treatment, therapy, support, a person has to want to combat the thoughts that brought them into the violent arena to begin with.
So some of these sexual predators, are they taught or do they just begin to believe at a very young age that they are entitled to be able to do these things?
From what we understand, certainly a negative home environment, negative peer system, having been abused, things and also simply personality traits of narcissism or aggression, et cetera, often lead to people deciding to become sex offenders or physical batters. So how they cope with the past is really the issue. How they choose to deal with people, whether respectfully or non-respectfully, also plays into that, whether they lack empathy or have empathy. And, of course, their support system. We've got family systems, as we heard with the Stanford swimmer, who his father really believed that what he did was no big deal. Well, the acorn didn't fall far from the tree. We have a family system that actually condoned rape.
Yeah. And then what I'm wondering, when you hear so many reports, I mean, it's only Tuesday, and we've already had two news reports in our area locally about, one, a child trying to be abducted, and then another report of a father being accused of sexual assault with his daughter. When you hear so many reports that keep coming out, it makes me wonder, are there more people out there that want to do this, that are resisting the urge to do this?
Oh, many, many more. Of course, it's, you know, if we take another problem like DWI, driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, people typically have done it hundreds of times before they get caught the first time. And so with physical and sexual violence, you know, certainly we see that by the time we arrest them, the majority have done this numerous times. In fact, one of the problems here is that only about 10% of sex assaults, psychologically coerced assaults, are reported, and only about 40% of rapes, physically forced attacks, are reported, which means the majority are not reported, or at least not reported in a timely fashion that they can be prosecuted. So by the time people do get caught and prosecuted, it's most common that they have multiple victims over years of engaging in this behavior.
So just last month, the Lee County Sheriff's Department hosted a seminar that filled with reservations really quickly. It was called RAPID, which is Response, Assess, Protect, Identify, and Defense. It was for high school females only, mainly targeting young women who are about to head to college so that they can arm themselves with tools to avoid situations that may put them at vulnerability to be attacked and to learn what they do if they do find themselves in that situation. And like I said earlier, it was really well attended, and there may be more planned for the future. But in your profession, do you see anything being done to address the predator in this situation?
Not so much. I think, you know, funding in most public schools and even colleges to address prevention programs has certainly been cut, and that is a problem. So we focus on the victims being able to – or potential victims to arm themselves better with knowledge and strategies to deal with a potentially violent or sexually aggressive person. But the downside to that is, of course – close to, you know, 70 to 90% of those perpetrators are known to the victim, and it's actually hard to protect yourself from someone that you like, love, respect. It's easier to go after a stranger. So it is helpful. It can reduce a sex assault in that they may be able to protect themselves better from the perpetrator. But more needs to be done also with educating, for example, males on appropriate boundaries, appropriate sexual boundaries, to understand that force is force. It doesn't matter. Someone not talking back, someone not participating back is as much a no or stop as the words.
Mm-hmm. So how are boys and young men being taught when it comes to these things? Do they just get their information as far as what's okay and what's not okay by what they see in the media? Or is it what they see handed down in the way of court cases, like you mentioned, the Stanford swimmer? Do they just accept that as what is societally acceptable?
You know, and that's a good question, because we don't really know. And, you know, certainly the late 90s into 2000s, you know, budget cuts happened, and therefore a lot of preventative programs, extracurricular programs, et cetera, that might have focused on how not to rape or abuse, for example, or how to be a good dad or boyfriend, programs get cut all the time. So we just, you know, there may not be the resources there that we spend to actually prevent the situation. And I say prevent, I mean a person has to choose to rape, but it would be nice if we could educate men at a younger age to understand what the boundaries really are and what the choices they have are that are available, so they can, you know, make a decision not to do this.
Mm-hmm. So how does the prevalence of the internet change things like this? Because there are those dark corners of the internet that kind of normalize some subversive behavior. Does that play a part?
It can play a very big part. And, you know, social media as a whole, whether it's music, movies, TV, people that are reality TV stars, certainly can set bad examples too. And the problem is many people who are famous and rich get off, get away with, or get a seriously minimized sentence for what they did, which sets the wrong example. Then again, we can talk about the web with pornography, and certainly we can get into deviant pornography, child rape, et cetera, type pornography, which is easily accessed, free, and if someone's actually choosing to indulge in that, it's a lot easier, therefore, to act those things out. In fact, there's a significant likelihood that most batterers and sex offenders spend a lot of time with deviant porn online.
There's been a connection made there?
There's a connection.
I mean, it kind of seems like – I just wanted to know scientifically they've connected that the people that are enacting these things kind of sometimes are emboldened by having seen it on – the internet, and it becomes kind of normal, like just
Correct. They become basically numb to it. They accept it. And if you think about just learning theory, they're reinforcing now a deviant theory every time they look at that pornography. And usually if we look at the media cases, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, Castro out of Ohio, who had the three women in his basement, often talked about how much time they spent with pornography and how they got deviant ideas from the pornography and felt that they had to try it. So if we take the deviant pornography out of it, it's not that we will wipe out sex offenders, but we probably would decrease the number.
Yeah, they might not become as emboldened to do so. And then I also wanted to touch on you recently published an article that raised a little bit of controversy saying that an intoxicated rapist knows what they're doing. Tell me about the study that was behind that article.
Well, I did a meta-analysis, which means I looked at the data that was already published and pooled that together into one article. And it was interesting that there were multiple studies that showed that, you know, really we know what we're doing when we're drunk. It's just we don't really want to hold people accountable when they're drunk, because if we hold them accountable, that means we have to hold ourselves accountable when we're drunk and do something stupid. And the reality is, however, rape is a complex behavior. There's multiple facets, multiple things. You have to control the victim. You have to be in a secure environment to do what you want to do and get away. It actually involves a lot of thinking. So to say I was too drunk to know what I was doing, well, no, because you actually found a victim. You did exactly what you wanted to do. It wasn't sloppy all over the place and you got caught right away. It was actually premeditated. You thought about the details, drunk or sober. Now, you care less about empathy and care less about the consequences when you're drunk. But people that do not have violent personality traits or significant negative family backgrounds, etc., growing up, even when drunk, they choose to pay attention to the victim's resistance and stop. Whereas people that have the violent personalities, the deviant beliefs, rape personalities, if you will, or the negative background, they chose to continue to hurt the victim, continue to engage in sex or physical violence, even when drunk. So drunk really didn't have anything to do with it, except it becomes an excuse that helps justify for the perpetrator what they did.
And it sometimes becomes a reason for a lighter sentence.
Correct.
When people are held accountable after the fact.
Correct. And in fact, there's studies to show that we hold a victim that was drunk or intoxicated at the time of the crime more responsible for putting herself in that situation drunk than we do the drunk perpetrator, even though the perpetrator had to engage in very thought out, deliberated behavior.
And that's what kind of brought up the subject of the show, is putting the onus on the prey rather than the predator in these situations. Remember, we were talking about how we have, you know, self-defense classes and things that put the onus of keeping themselves safe on the victim rather than keeping the responsibility on the predator in these situations.
Correct. And, you know, part of the problem, and as a man, I'll say this, is it's a male-driven society. We have men making laws about women's bodies. We have men making laws about rape that mostly involves female victims. The reality is rape is a chosen behavior, and you have to want to do it to do it. Domestic abuse, child sexual abuse, you have to want to do it. It's not like you just wake up one day and say, I'm born to do it. There's no evidence it's genetic or biologic. It is a groomed or learned behavior over time that you have to choose to want to do. And yet we blame the victim for being at the right place at the wrong time.
Yeah. We are talking with Scott Johnson. He's a forensic psychologist, about the mentality of a sex offender and how society can look to the offender rather than the victim for solutions. If you have a thought or a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So if a person's prone to violence or possible sexual violence, what can society at large do? Can friends or family do anything to intervene?
Well, when we think about trying to intervene with a problem that we know is likely to happen, for example, you know, with sex offenses, let's say they have committed a sex offense and we're concerned that they're going to do another one. We can't arrest them for what they might do. We can encourage people to get into appropriate treatment programs. We can lengthen probation and parole supervision and hold the sex offenders accountable. And most states do a good job with this. Supervision is intense. We have registration, et cetera. But for those people that, for example, they've served their time, they're off probation or parole, for those people, you know, we know that over 50%, probably closer to 60%+ over the course of years are going to reoffend. And yet we're stuck waiting until they reoffend and get caught, rather. We don't know anything, you know, so we have options. We could certainly give people longer sentences to begin with, for example, for certain types of sex offenses that are more heinous, or if they're on their second or third offense, perhaps we need to start looking at life in prison, because even civil commitment costs so much more money than simply giving a prison sentence based on the crimes that they do.
So what is civil commitment?
Civil commitment is we could take someone that's already served their time and put them in a sexually violent predator program and for life or until they're deemed treated. And it's different because it's in between a state hospital and a prison. It's in between the two. It's a locked facility. They cannot come and go as they please. It's secured and treatment's available if they want to partake of it. Now, the problem there is all states are different in that. Some states have an excellent sexually violent predator program, and others, like Florida, have some that are actually substandard. And that is a problem because that means we don't have adequately trained staff to actually deal with this very, very dangerous population. And now for families, if we think someone is going down the path of demonstrating sexually violent behavior, certainly talking direct to them. You know, don't beat around the bush. Just ask the right questions. Deal with it. They need to see a therapist that specializes with sexually violent behavior, and we need to intervene. Basically, hold them accountable. But in the long run, there's nothing we can do if they're not willing to do treatment.
And they're not willing to engage in that conversation.
Right. Then we're stuck.
Yeah. So what does a neighbor do, for example? Say you know that there's a registered sex offender that lives in your neighborhood, but then you see that person who's no longer under supervision that has now a lady friend who has a couple of kids and they keep hanging out and you see them kind of grooming that family to be taken advantage of. Is there anything a neighbor can do in that kind of a situation?
Certainly. The first thing is notify law enforcement. And even though there may not be anything they can immediately do, the situation gets documented. And documentation of every piece is important because at some point they're going to slip. The police are going to be directly involved. And now we've got this paper trail of reports and concerns. However, your concern may warrant an arrest or intervention because now you're calling attention to law enforcement of a situation that's dangerous. Second thing you could do, which you have to be careful how you do this so you don't put your own safety at risk, is, you know, try to talk to the female and let them know that this person is in fact a registered sex offender or that they committed an offense and you're concerned about what you're seeing. The downside is most of the females involved with these perpetrators are already being groomed. They're not likely to believe what other people say. The sex offenders already minimized their past history or any significant concerns, and they're really making this adult female more dependent on them, which means it's easier to keep grooming.
Mm-hmm. We have a call coming in, I think. Oh, I'm sorry. She's not there. We do have a call coming in a minute, but I'll get to that in 1 second. Another thing that comes up when it comes to sexual misconduct is in employment laws. Say somebody gets fired at one work location for sexual misconduct of some way. They go on and they go get a job somewhere else, and nobody is able to report that kind of misconduct to future employers. Is that something that's new?
No, it's, you know, every employer fears getting sued for releasing information about why someone's terminated, and yet it creates a safety concern, especially for licensable professions, teaching, medical, psychology, daycare, religion, where we entrust youth and others to these people we hire. And so not knowing, you know, that the previous employment was terminated because of sexual misconduct, and yet we hire the same person is a bad thing.
Yeah, there's just no clearinghouse for that. There's
no clearinghouse. No.
Because they haven't been convicted of anything. It's just something happened and they were let go, but you can't say what caused it.
Correct. And the problem is the employer, if we're – you know, they'd be sued and they'd have to actually prove the allegation. And oftentimes we have enough to say we're not comfortable with your conduct. You're an employee at will. We're terminating you. But we can't prove the sexual misconduct, but certainly we suspect it strongly. And the problem is that's the piece there is we can't necessarily – we don't know for sure that they did what they're accused of doing.
All right. So we do have our caller on the line who's ready to go. Katie in Venice. What would you like to say, Katie?
First of all, I think sexual abuse is the worst kind of crime, and it should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But on the other hand, I think that there are people that fall through the cracks, and this should be enormously important because lives are ruined. I have a family member that had a single incident when he was young and sent a sex picture to another young girl. And he was, because of the charge, the judge said that he shouldn't be listed as a sexual predator. But because of the charge, the state decided that he had to be. And no problem since then, never was a problem before that, simply something stupid that a young person did. And his life is ruined. He can't do anything. He can't even go back to court because there is a possibility he could go to jail by reopening the case. And that's wrong. I also have had the opportunity to visit an institution in the middle of the state where there are thousands of men that are being housed after they've paid their debt to society in a locked facility that has is a privately paid by the state of Florida. And instead of putting our money in housing that may be 50%, why can't we have more programs in the schools that help young men to understand the difference between right and wrong?
Okay, and I'm going to have the answer and say thank you for your comment. A couple of issues to address there. One is having a record that haunts you for life if it's – you know, and that's kind of up for opinion, what's a stupid young mistake and what's an actual crime. And well, not actually up for opinion. That's so there's that. And then there's also the men who are, she described as having served their time and then still having to pay that price. So how would you respond to either of those concerns?
Well, to the latter, the sexually violent predator program that she's referring to is designed to take the more dangerous sexual predators off the street so that we're not having to wait until they reoffend. And so there's a process that's there for that, to protect society. Now, the other side of it is, yes, once you're convicted of a sex crime, whether by plea or jury or judge, your life does change. Now, is it possible that you will be rehabilitated and never do it again? There are some that certainly do not reoffend. However, we know that over half – per the research, do reoffend within their lifetime, within 20, 25 years or sooner. And that's an underestimation. That's what we know. So we know it's a minimum of half that are going to reoffend. So the ongoing registration and limitations that may be implied to a sex offender's life is to protect the good of all over the good of one, who's already demonstrated their desire, willingness, et cetera, to hurt other people. Not to say someone can't change and not to say you can't find a way to take that back to court to say we'd like this revisited. It's been 5 years or 10 years. We've had no same or similar offense. That's something you may be able to present.
Yeah. But that gives us to the final thought, though. Why can't we teach young boys what's appropriate and what's not appropriate? And you've even written a book, Man to Man, When Your Partner Says No, that was used in classrooms for a long time, but the funding ended up getting cut on some of these things and they just it becomes not a priority.
Well, yes. I mean, exactly. It's not a priority, and especially when you have men making the decisions about these type of things, we don't want to educate more men that what they may be doing as men are wrong. And so, yes, we do need to have more education available to explain, you know, we do good touch, bad touch in some elementary schools, but we also need to look at what sexual assault and rape are and educate both men and women about this.
Mm-hmm. We have another question on the line from Charmaine in Naples. Charmaine, what would you like to ask?
This one, I really think, will challenge you. I read a really sad story last night about a teenage boy that was caught attempting to sexually assault a neighbor's dog, and he had done it in the past. The reason it was a big story was that another neighbor saw it and pulled a gun on him, and she's being charged. However, what on earth can this kid's parents do? I mean, there must be some way to help this kid. Obviously, this is a huge red flag that something's very wrong.
Okay, and we'll take your answer off the phone. And how would you respond to that? What can be done when you see a kid doing something like that young?
Well, certainly when we have a child engaging in any type of violent behavior, physical, sexual, toward animals, fire setting, anything like that, it's a serious, serious red flag that they're heading in the direction to become more physically and or sexually violent. We want to get that person help. We want them to be assessed by a professional psychologist or psychiatrist that specializes in sexually deviant behavior or sexual offender behavior. And again, we do not take this behavior lightly. It's not an experiment. It's not something people just do for the whim of doing it. It's actually an indication of usually underlying problems that are pretty serious that you may well result in this person becoming, well, they have become a sex offender because they're molesting an animal.
So I wanted to ask, when does a person's proclivity towards violence, and in particular sexual violence, when does that take shape? At what age?
We can start to see antisocial type behavior starting out at 5, 10 years old. It may not become sexualized until puberty or, puberty 18, 20, somewhere in there. But we do see indications for many of these kids, but they may be involved in the system. It may be acting out. They may have a diagnosis of ADHD, which most of the time is wrong. It's just they appear that. But they're engaged. They may be witnessing violence at home. They may have permissive parenting going on, parental, family, and friend attitudes that condone physical violence or rape or child molestation, as well as personality traits of narcissism, antisociality, and certainly a lack of empathy and conscience.
So that starts early.
It starts early, yeah.
So what's a parent's responsibility? I mean, what can a parent who's conscientious do to try to steer the kid away from that kind of behavior?
Yes, we need to make sure, again, that the child and family are seen by someone who specializes in sex offense or physically violent behavior, a psychologist, a psychiatrist. Now, the problem here is that if you have a family that also condones part of the problem of degrading women, for example, or sexualizing anger, the family is usually not likely to participate, which means the child may or may not get help. But if the child starts to get help, there's a chance the family can undermine any gains made. But seeking mental health help is important.
Mm-hmm. So you say that the vast majority of these sexual assaults are perpetrated by acquaintances. Are there any signals that these people send before an assault? Or are there any certain key words or actions that a potential victim, or even if it's a girlfriend of or boyfriend of, I mean, that they can look out for?
Yeah, there's two extremes on a continuum. One is many of the sex offenders are just very good at conning and being cunning and loving until they're ready to pounce, which means you may not see anything coming. Now, at the other extreme, we have people that are already talking demeaning. They refer to women or other men in sexualized, objectifying manners. They're quick to get violent or verbally aggressive. They're quick to blame others for their own behavior. When we start to see those kind of red flags, those are usually people we do not want to be out alone with, and we really don't want to be friends with.
And then they try to, kind of isolate the person and keep the friends away when they go out.
They do a couple things. One is they try to isolate by wanting to control, spend time with, and they try to demean the potential victim's family and friends so that the victim now has to choose between family and friends and this person.
Is there anything that friends can do in these situations when they see their friend or even sister or whoever being led down that kind of a path? Is there some way to reel them back in?
Well, mostly we have to first and foremost get the person physically out of that situation so we can talk alone. And that's where you're going to have more effectiveness to actually have the potential victim actually hear you. If you try to talk with them via social media or telephone, but the perpetrator's there, you're probably not going to be heard as loudly. So we need to first and foremost get that person out of the situation. And secondly, in as direct and caring manner as we are, you know, expressing that we're concerned for your safety, we're seeing behaviors that are not acceptable, and reiterate, it's not your fault for being conned here, but you appear to be being conned. Because many victims, they're embarrassed. They're embarrassed that they, in their mind, let their guard down when, in fact, they didn't let the guard down. This person manipulated that guard down.
Mm-hmm. So when you have somebody that is, you know, maybe kind of came close to this kind of a dangerous situation, does that kind of make more of a case for throwing the book at smaller infractions? Because if that person does not get what they want out of that person, the single victim, will they go on to then seek other victims? Or will they think again and say, well, maybe that wasn't the way to be?
Well, again, it depends on the level of conscience and empathy skills and how much they've sexualized their anger. But some people can and do change behaviors. We know that. Some, on, you know, a few on there, mostly with help, though, from the therapy community. But we have to also realize that the majority are going to reoffend, especially without any type of intervention, because it's partly personality, partly experiences. But we all know it's hard. We try a diet. We try exercise. We do it for 3 months, and then we're back to doing the same thing we shouldn't be doing. And now we're talking about aggression and sex tied together, which are highly reinforcing just in and of themselves to vent, that it's difficult for people to choose not to do it again. However, I want to state clearly, they are never out of control. Even Jeffrey Dahmer, who granted was one of the most sick, mentally disturbed sex offenders that we had, he had hundreds if not thousands of consenting sex partners. He only had one or two victims a year that we knew of. So he was able to control his deviant behavior and thoughts until situations were perfect to actually engage in the offense behavior. So no one's ever out of control. Do not blame alcohol or drugs. People know what they're doing when they're drunk. People know what they're doing when they're being aggressive. Hold them accountable and do not accept it. And some of the reality talk shows, Teen Mom 2, we've got Janelle on there who boyfriend after boyfriend demonstrates yelling, and they yell, both of them yell at each other with the kid in the house. The kid's growing up with fear. And so we want to talk about family dynamics and how social media can actually promote this as normal behavior. It's not normal to yell. It's not normal to degrade. And it's never normal to force sexual contact.
Are there any changes in culture in the United States that's showing any kind of progress on this issue?
Well, we're becoming more open to prosecution in longer sentences. But the problem is it's state to state, and even within states, it may be region to region. So we need to do a better job at educating and holding people accountable. However, we do have cases that undermine us all the time. We've got teachers that are arrested that get, you know, 6 months probation instead of 5 years in prison. We have female offenders that get a fraction of what the male offenders do, and they're back reoffending or hurting again. Stanford swimmer again. We got Bill Cosby's allegations. We got, you know, fame, fortune, money. And just people's wanting to blame victims is kind of standing in the way of taking the problem a bit more serious.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave things there right now because we've kind of run up against time. But I want to thank our guest, Scott Johnson, forensic psychologist and FGCU professor. It's a tough topic, but one that needs to be tackled. So thank you for being part of our show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, it is time to do the stingray shuffle to avoid a barb in the foot. But does this annual dance at the beach even work? We'll talk with a stingray expert about stingray mating season along the beaches, what's in that venom, and new research that could add to humans' antibiotic arsenal. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.